This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Are you ready for impeachment trial 2.0, which begins today? You better be, because if you're a Trump voter, it's you who is on trial. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Schumer and McConnell have agreed to the structure of the trial. Debate and vote Tuesday, today, on whether the trial is constitutional. This is a rerun of the Rand Paul straw vote from last week. Opening arguments tomorrow. Both sides have 16 hours over 2 days to present their case to the Senate, which is a faster pace than both the Clinton trial as well as the first Trump trial.
Yeah, that was 3 days. Now it's to two.
The deal leaves the door open to calling witnesses. Will be paused on Saturday to accommodate a request from one of Trump's attorneys to observe the Jewish Sabbath. If both sides use all the time that would set up opening arguments to wrap on Sunday, there are time to have questions asked of both sides as well as potential deliberations. Both sides get 2 hours for closing arguments. The whole sum total of it could be wrapped up by early next week if it goes as anticipated, which is not much in the way of witnesses. Just everybody getting their turn at the wheel to speechify and then calling the question.
Yeah, I mean, Democrats are going to, you know, lay out their case using social media and videos. And Trump's lawyers, who wrote a 78-page letter, you know, basically saying that, you know, he was speaking in a figurative sense when he said this on January 6th.
We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore.
Yeah, and he went on to explain, you know, that the riots was a small group. Then it was a planned attack by them, not by President Trump's or his actions.
Yeah, but do you understand that you're on trial if you're a Trump voter? It's you who are on trial. Let me offer some evidence, since we're talking about trials, in advance of my point. Chris Hayes, MSNBC, tweeting out over the weekend, "The shamelessness of Republicans on Sunday shows is a sight to behold. You got hundreds of thousands of Americans killed, and then helped a deadly attack on the Capitol to stop the peaceful transfer of power. And it's all, well, shucks, why are Democrats so divisive? They damn near destroyed the gosh darn," except that's not what he used, "country. Unprecedented death and destruction and misery and mourning. Absent some apology, and honestly, nothing they have to say is worth anything at all, at all, at all." Chris Hayes, MSNBC. "You got hundreds of thousands of Americans killed and then helped a deadly attack on the Capitol to stop the peaceful transfer of power." You did.
Wait, what hundreds of thousands of Americans is he talking about?
COVID.
Oh, you, come on. Really? That's a bit of a stretch.
You did that. He didn't say Trump did that. He says you did that. More evidence? Jake Tapper on CNN. "What to do about holding people accountable who repeated the, as he terms it, the big lie about the election, that the election was stolen, the big lie."
What about accountability for the others who helped spread the big election lie that incited the crowd? If there is no accountability and no attempt by the Republican Party to stop these insane lies that have taken root in their party, witness the support this week by the House Republicans for bigot and conspiracy theorist Marjorie Taylor Greene, the congresswoman from Georgia. If there's no effort at accountability, this is not going to be the end of MAGA terrorism. This will only be the beginning.
You did this. MAGA terrorism that you're a part of. You're either a material participant or you're an aider and abettor. Do you understand?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA. Then a quick comment. Who's sick of being vilified? Who's had enough? I mean, I did my part by telling my family members who actually thought that the election was going to be overturned on January 6th, sat them down, let them know that that is not going to happen. But they still believe that the election was rigged. They will their entire lives, and I can't change their minds.
Yeah, so,
well, we're not all. I mean, we're not all.
What's your point?
My point is that I'm not responsible for killing 100,000 people, and I'm not responsible for what happened on January 6th.
Right. But do people appreciate that this is the angle of incidents from the left? All hands on deck of the make-believers and the professional agitators and these well-funded Marxist organizations that are rewriting the history of the last 4 years and the last 4 weeks. Do you have an appreciation for that? Because I get the sense that most people think that this is some sort of referendum on Trump, or this is just simply the divisiveness any divisiveness within Democrat ranks is ameliorated by focusing on Trump. In other words, Trump hatred is a unifying force in the Democrat Party. It's the only thing really they have other than, you know, general support for cultural Marxism. But it's not just that. Do you understand that their disposition is to come after you in one of two ways, either to silence you because they know they can't convert everybody, they can't bend everyone to their will, they can't get everybody to voice support for their worldview. So they'll silence some by making an example of others. And they'll make examples of people that have some profile to silence the people who don't. And if you step out of line, well, then you could be labeled a violent extremist. You could be labeled a purveyor of hate speech. And that's when they'll come after you, when you stick your head up. Because you're guilty. You see? You're guilty. You're guilty of killing hundreds of thousands of people. You're guilty of precipitating an attack, an insurrection, to use their word, in the Capitol on January 6th. That's why this trial is relevant. You shouldn't just turn a blind eye to it, because this is just one more chapter in the book they're writing about you. Oh, and by the way, for those surrender Republicans that want to advance that position the left is taking, that project they're executing. You know, the Wall Street Journal editorial board, not exactly a bunch of Trumpian, rebels. This is their commentary today. The assault on the Capitol was a riot and a violent one, but it wasn't an insurrection. Was not. It wasn't a coup. Law enforcement was overwhelmed, but it was all on the side of the Congress. Once the mob was dispersed, the members returned to the House chamber to count the votes. There was never any chance that Joe Biden would not become president on January 20th, whatever the fantasies of Mr. Trump and his courtiers, just to make the point about where their disposition on Trump. Remember, this is the same editorial board that called on Trump to resign. And yet, at minimum, at least, they are setting the record straight with respect to January 6th and with respect to Trump voters generally. And the Republican Party best see fit to do that too, lest Chris Hayes and Jake Tapper and their propagandizing wins the day. Tom in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan and Amy, good morning. Dan, definitely it's an attack on the everyday man, on those not in the political establishment. And you've said for years about how not to get behind these people like they're gods. And I don't think Trump is a god, and I never did. I started out supporting Scott Walker. This is an attack on the non-political class. If anyone says the word insurrection to me, I already know to zone them out. Don't tell me a couple of hundred knuckleheads wearing clown hats put like AOC's life in danger. This is an attack on the everyday person. I heard that got Chris Hayes bit. He didn't blame China at all. Jake Tapper, they say nothing about China. You would think Trump created the China virus in Mar-a-Lago. You really would.
Thanks, Tom. Here's the other thing. You're not allowed this by calling this a big lie. really any inquiry about how the election was conducted in 2020, any discussion other than codifying how the election was conducted in 2020, any discussion at the state level about signature requirements, about voter ID, about culling the voter rolls for people that are not eligible to vote. This is all of a kind of propagating the big lie about the election being stolen or these anomalies. Any questions about them, then you are a co-conspirator, you see? It's a way to shut people up. It's a way to delegitimize the argument. It's a way to paper over any uncomfortable questions about a lot of things that don't jibe with what happened in 2020. A lot of legitimate questions raised that have not been answered, but you can't ask those questions. Yeah. If you do, you're part and parcel to the rioting, the violence that occurred on January 6th. You understand? So now we don't have to defend ourselves. I mean, this was all detailed, ironically, to some extent, by Molly Ball's piece in Time magazine about the secret campaign in 2020 that we discussed a bit yesterday with Mark Hemingway. It's a piece that's making the rounds. The effort that was made well in advance of the election to get a quote-unquote bipartisan group together, and of course the way to make sure that everybody believes it's legitimate is to do these things in secret. Secret proceedings to make sure everybody knows things are on the up and up. Try to reconcile those two statements. But it was what? We're going to get people together. We're going to put pressure on social media platforms to eliminate what we say is untrue, to deplatform those who are posting information that we say is untrue. And this is a way to avoid things going viral, illegitimate claims that are not backed by any evidence, as well as legitimate claims that run counter to our ends. That's what happened in 2020. That's what's continuing, actually increasing in pace in 2021. Mike in Plano.
Hey guys. Speaking of surrender Republicans, I heard Liz Cheney on TV the other day say that Donald Trump has no future in the Republican Party. Now, that statement puts her at odds with her own party leader, and that's not Donald Trump, that's Kevin McCarthy. Because just a couple weeks ago, Kevin McCarthy went down to Mar-a-Lago, got on his hands and knees, and begged Trump to help him win back the House in 2022. So she might want to check with her party leader for verification of that. And this is why the Republicans should have removed her from leadership. Because now you have mixed messaging and you have a woman in leadership that undermines the base and demoralizes them.
Well,
do you think she should have been removed, Dan?
I really don't care. I mean, it's, you know, an internal caucus matter. I don't really care. They didn't have the votes to remove her, so she's not removed. But in terms of foretelling who does and who does not have a future in the Republican Party, if I were Liz Cheney facing what looks like an uphill battle for re-election to my seat in Wyoming, I wouldn't spend a lot of time running around telling people who does and does not have a future in my party. I'd be worrying about my own future.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and we were talking before Mike Scott's newscast about the interminable impeachment process, something that Democrats have been pursuing since the first 20 minutes of the Trump administration, and even after the end of the Trump administration. Something else that's interminable that seems to be in a continuous loop is the Chicago public school system with respect to the desire of teachers to work. You know, they strike and then they come back and then they strike and effectively walk out, refuse to learn, refuse to pick their heads up and look around at what's happening in the rest of the country, even the rest of Illinois, and take any heed. And so today we get the CTU rank and file voting on this tentative agreement that was put together by Mayor Triple Threat and Bolshevik Sharkey over the weekend.
I mean, your favorite thing, the House of Delegates, Dan, all 600 members voted last night, 85% in favor of the deal. Rank and file, they're going to vote today via Zoom. And then, you know, that'll take an extra day. So we're sure to go back Thursday, but I'm sure they'll push it off to Friday for in-person learning for pre-K and special education kids. But if you really look at this deal is horrible. They want to shut down the schools if there's three cases in a school. And there could be three kids that don't even have that know that they have it. You know, if they randomly get tested, because that's what they want to, part of testing, if they randomly get tested and they might have it, they'll shut it all down again.
So like in impeachment trial 2.0, this is a foregone conclusion. And the point here is to rally the troops on the left and continue to watch their political opponents sort of dither and join in ignoring any discomfort they may have experienced, right? After this is inked, both sides, to pretend, you know, we're talking about make-believers here. So we all indulge this delusion. We all participate in this delusion of pretending that Triple Threat and the teachers' unions are two sides. So both camps within on the same side will celebrate today. To both declare victory. Mm-hmm. We'll both talk about a time for healing and how they put the parents and the kids first, and safety first, and they saved lives. And then we'll all just, skip along and pretend that nothing happened, and the cycle will repeat itself again and again over the next 50 years, just as it has the previous 50, right?
Right. And I even told one of my neighbors, she said, well, is this going to happen again? I go, oh, honey, this happens every 4 to 5 years when their contract is up. They will always strike. They did it in 87. They did it in 2012, 2019, and now again. And yesterday I went to her press conference because I'm sick of this pool reporter bull jive. Because we're in phase four now, Dan, don't you know, where we can just have 50 or more people in a room if we're spread out. And I went there because it was at the South Shore Cultural Center. I wasn't, you know, invading City Hall. I'm sitting down, and this lady comes up to me and said, you need to leave. And I said, why? And she said, well, we have a pool reporter here, and you cannot ask any questions, and you have got to leave right now. And I said, well, I'm in a public space. I also have my press pass here, and you're, you know, trampling my First Amendment right to free speech and freedom of the press, and I'm not moving. So you could call the police, call security, and have them physically remove me, but I have a right to be here as a citizen and as a journalist, because they had some groundbreaking for Sisters in Cinema Media Arts Center. And then after that, we went to the hallway. Well, I'm just saying, they want to control the message so badly that this, I feel like we're living in a communist country. This has been going on for almost a year now, where Mayor Lightfoot has one reporter in, and then you try to get your questions into the reporter to ask the questions. You see what I'm saying? That's not a normal, sustainable system. And that's why, I honestly, the question that I asked yesterday was unbelievable, that she does not know that the IHSA, Illinois Department of Public Health, Illinois School Board, have all given us the green light for sports. So Marianne Ahern, who I was standing next to, said, Amy Jacobson from WIND has a question about sports and why we're not playing sports when we have the green light to do so. And guess what she said? This made everyone's stomach turn, especially coaches throughout Chicago Public School Leagues.
The Illinois State Board of Education, but also the Illinois High School Association. We've been anxiously waiting for further guidance from them. As a unrepentant sports fan myself, I'd like to see kids get back. There is some releasing of the guidelines to let some non-contact sports happen. But that, as far as I know, we haven't seen anything that's specific to, for example, high school basketball. So I'd like to see us move in that direction, but the state really controls the play, no pun intended, on that issue.
But the suburbs are playing.
Say it again.
The suburbs are playing sports.
They are playing some sports.
So she has no clue, zero clue what is going on. We got the green light 2 weeks ago, Mayor Lightfoot. What are you doing about it?
You would think that she'd read the AFL-CIO Times. So over the weekend, there was a picture of Loyola's Scotty Dean, number 33, maintaining possession of the ball as he drives past Main South's Ryan Modert, number 21. They're both wearing masks. It's a great picture that the AFL-CIO Times ran because it summarizes the criminal insanity of the political class in this state in one picture. So it was very helpful. And I would think that would be something that Mayor Triple Threat would pay attention to, the AFL-CIO Times, even if she doesn't pay attention to pronouncements from IHSA or is her bubble is so thick that she doesn't recognize what's happening in the suburbs. And the question I thought when I saw that clip was, which is thicker, Lightfoot's bubble or Pritzker's girdle? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro, text line.
I mean, her ignorance of the situation surprised many coaches, but a lot of us were led to believe that we weren't back on the court because of the labor dispute. No, we weren't not. We should have had basketball start a week ago, last Monday. Tryouts should have been Monday. It had nothing to do with that. She is concentrated on
it's just
the
one
CTU
basketball season.
No, yeah, it's just 14 days. Why do you complain?
We're starting to get that geared up here in Chicago, but I thought the question was really specific to things like high school basketball. I'm not aware of that happening. I've been watching it pretty closely.
No, you haven't.
But if there is a pathway as allowed by the state, then we will start looking into that.
And so then her press person told me later yesterday, she said, well, we're going to look into CPS basketball this week. And I said, no, you should allow it. The piece of paper is on Janice Jackson's desk. All we need her to do is sign it, and then we can have tryouts. But we have to get 7 practices in before we can have a game. And we're up against the clock because the season's only 3 weeks long, and we're in the second week. So what does that mean, Dan? We're not going to have a season.
It means you don't have a season. Even if you have a season, you don't have a season.
No, well, I mean, but even if we could play 2 or 3 games, some parents are like, I'll just be happy if we play 1 game. Just get my daughter and my sons out of the house so they could have something to look forward to. And she doesn't understand that kids are dying mentally. They're dying personally. They need this. And she doesn't care because she doesn't know, because she's surrounded herself with people who aren't doing their jobs. And they're supposed to inform her of what is going on, tell her what is going on, show her what is going on.
Well, don't worry, because the table scraps will be forthcoming soon in the next couple, 3-4 weeks. So you'll have your table scraps, and then everything will be right with the world. Oh, by the way, unbeknownst to anybody, there's a legislation kicking around in Springfield to start sex education in kindergarten. Yeah. The Responsible Education for Adolescent and Children's Health, or REACH Act, as it's Orwellian named, would start sex ed in kindergarten through second grade with lessons on personal safety and respecting others. Grades 3 through 5 would cover anatomy, sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender expression. Grades 6 through 12 would build upon that to include the benefits of birth control and prevention of STDs.
Kindergarten?
So I can't wait to get those kindergartners, because that's right the priority here in Chicago and around the state. Can't wait to get those kids back in school so they can get right to learning about sex and gender identity and otherwise be inculcated with this leftist identitarian propaganda just as soon as possible. Can't wait. So important to get them back for this, right?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Greg in LaGrange, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. Yeah, Dan, maybe you can explain to me how this union vote's going to work, because they need a quorum. How is this vote going to be, how is the integrity of this vote going to be ensured? The other thing is, what's their motive to come back when the president of the United States says that we need to have heating systems reconfigured for safety?
The air filtration systems, and we did it.
Yeah, well, here's the other thing. While all of this is going on, as Dan just pointed out, you have some insidious educational policies being pushed by Illinois, Minnesota, the power line guys. Mr. Hinderaker explained that pretty well. And Christopher Rufo has done a very good job in describing what's been happening in California and Missouri. This is why they want to get these kids back, and this is why we have to give Empower.org every chance to get people, to get money to people to take their kids out, because eventually even that avenue is going to be shut down.
EmpowerIllinois.org. Yeah, thanks for the call, Greg. And right, I mean, that's legislation animated that program for 5 years. you're coming up on that, needs to be re-upped. It needs to be re-upped every year. It sunsets in 5 years, or it could be killed by a supermajority of Marxists in the General Assembly, along with Governor Pritzker. Oh, meanwhile, in other states, just to remind you how other people live.
Yeah, please. Take us to our happy place, please.
The Iowa Senate passed a bill to provide students assigned to low-performing public schools. So that would be about 95% of Chicago public schools were this to be advanced in Illinois. Iowa Senate passed a bill to provide students assigned to low-performing schools with education savings account, similar to opportunity scholarships, but can also be used for textbooks, tutoring, and more. Parents can roll over unused funds to future years. Wow. So just like a medical savings account or, works that way. Legislation would also allow charter schools that are independent of local school districts. Today, the state only has two charter schools, so they're trying to expand choice in the state of Iowa. Florida Republican State Senator Manny Diaz has introduced a bill to consolidate the state's current scholarship programs into taxpayer-funded education savings accounts. Nearly 200,000 students in Florida already participate in the state's existing programs, only one of which uses ESAs. A GOP state senator in Arizona is proposing to expand eligibility for their state's educational savings accounts. Public schools in 33 states have lost 500,000 students since the 2019-2020 school year, according to an Associated Press Chalkbeat analysis. And so this is the migration towards homeschooling, the migration towards these parental pods, the migration towards private schooling, if you have the funds or can get access to the funds. And what is the left's position? To try to eliminate your choices. Why would they try to eliminate your choices? Because it's the way they prop up their system. So if you really want to do something important beyond just beating the drum of getting kids back to school, you should say that I think the campaign should be get kids back to the right school. Get kids back to a school where they can earn an education. Get kids back to a school that puts them on a pathway to success in life, not just any old Bolshevik re-education center masquerading as a school. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Not China's fault. No, it was not the Chi-Com's fault.
Was it me?
The COVID-19. The World Health Organization, a Chinese-owned and operated, has announced that the virus did not likely escape from the Wuhan virology lab, but rather is more likely to have been transmitted from an animal to a human, and that's what started the spread. So don't go blaming President Xi and those good people over in Beijing.
Not that the WHO is paid off heavily by China, but yeah, no, I'm not buying that for 2 seconds, are you? So it came from the bat at the wet market, which the mainstream media has been saying all along?
Some have not, but I'm sure they'll be happy to, as the Associated Press did, amplify this dubious information without any consideration. There won't be any warnings in Dorsey World about the WHO's press release on behalf of the Chinese communists, of course. And the Trump administration, senior national security officials there, including Pompeo, suggested in the closing days of that administration that it was pretty clear that it did come from the virology lab. Whether it was purposeful or accidental is an open question. So here we go again. We're going to have our press corps, I suspect, we'll see them doing the bidding of Chinese communists. The same way our press corps 50 years ago was largely doing the bidding of Soviet communists during the height of the Cold War and obviously into the Reagan era, when he in a dastardly fashion called the Soviet Union the evil empire, to the chagrin of the D.C. press corps. It hasn't changed over the last 40 years. It's just gotten worse and more allied, more sympathetic to America's enemies at least the foreign ones. That's been clear, and so we'll see how this plays out. But it calls for a stop, look, and listen on all things COVID-19 related, including the infringements on your liberty and our comedy as a populace, C-O-M-I-T-Y, as well as C-O-M-E-D-Y.
E-D-Y, yes.
A comedy and comedy. And Tony Fauci was on with our friend Brett Barron, special report, saying, you know, this mask wearing has to go on until...
Until when?
Until he says so.
Watching the Super Bowl last night, kudos to the NFL. They got the season through, and it was exciting to watch. But is there going to be a time when we're going to be no masks? When is that time? If you had to guess, going to a sports game, going to a theater, going to a concert without a mask?
You know, Brett, that will really be dependent upon how we get the level of virus in the community down. If we can get, and I have used this as an estimate, it's not definitive, that if we can get 70 to 85% of our population vaccinated and get to what we would hope would be to a degree of herd immunity, which really is an umbrella or a veil of protection against the community, where the level of virus is so low, it's not a threat at all, then at that point, you could start thinking in terms of not having to have uniform wearing of masks. But
so as soon as there's no possibility of transmission, meaning there's no possibility that it continues to exist.
That's never going to happen. You cannot eradicate a cold. You can't eradicate the flu. And this is part of a flu. This is a strain of the flu. And it's never going to happen. And he knows that because he's the doctor.
And this is part of what we're seeing in the reporting now, Wall Street Journal this week. As COVID-19 vaccines raise hope, cold reality dawns that illness is likely here to stay. The ease of transmission, new strains, limits of vaccination programs all mean COVID-19 will be around for years and big business. Well, there you go. Not only will it be around for years, and thus you'll have those using this as the basis to exercise control over others take full advantage, it becomes a cottage industry, and so you'll have a built-in constituency around continuing with these all the policies of the COVID enthusiasts and the authoritarian inclined. Isn't that nice? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. If you're not leaving a make-believer state, a lockdowner state for a free state because of your child's education, you may want to think about it in conjunction with your personal individual freedoms, your constitutionally enshrined liberties, combined with your child's education. Is that enough to get you to rethink being a California, Illinois, New Jersey, New York resident?
I'm moving. I can't wait. But yet again, I still have, you know, three more years here, two and a half more years because of the situation we're in. But we're not doing this next year, so I might take the child out of state. That's always a possibility. But think about our freedoms. Kids can't go to school for in-person learning, yet 54% of our tax dollars goes to teachers who aren't teaching. Churches closed. Kids can't play sports. But yet, you know what I did over the weekend? I go to a casino, and I called strip clubs. And all the strip clubs, Dan, just in case you're wondering, are still open in Chicago and in the Chicago area.
I'm not wondering, but I'm glad you're on top of that beat.
Yeah. And then also, the mayor of Tampa, you know, because they had a successful Super Bowl. Congratulations to the Bucks. The videos of people not wearing masks, she's now opening a police investigation, and they're going to come and find you. Listen to this.
So I'm proud of our community, but those few bad actors will be identified, and the Tampa Police Department will handle it. There just has to be that level of personal responsibility. You can supply everyone with a mask, advise them of the science behind it, and expect that they are going to abide by the mask order. Again, you're going to find a few that don't. The majority that I saw were wearing masks.
Uh-huh. So those videos that have been flying around, they're going to come and find you?
Yeah. Well, they're going to run into Governor DeSantis and his state legislation prohibiting local mask ordinances.
Good.
That's number one. So that much more in terms of the impetus to live in a free state versus a state full of make-believers where you have to share in the delusion to survive, at least survive with some modicum of freedom. And again, this is all parceled out, you know, just like information from Fauci, parceled out in chunks that you can handle according to them. So restaurants in Chicago begging to go from 25% capacity to 50% capacity. Oh, indoor dining resuming end of week in New York. Isn't that wonderful? The Supreme Court weighing in on California's unconstitutional infringements on religious liberty to write that opportunity for California residents. But, I mean, you're playing whack-a-mole with these make-believers, these lockdowners, And boy, I don't know. That's going to get exhausting. And that certainly includes now the federal government. Transportation Security Administration, TSA, announcing last week will begin fining travelers up to $1,500 for failing to wear a proper face mask.
And who's going to decide what is proper?
Well, that's what the
TSA is
there for.
It's so arbitrary. No, because in one airport I'll go to, you see one with a gator and they let that slide. And in other airports, you know, you can just wear a shield. I mean, it's just so arbitrary.
It's not just what you're wearing. It's how you're wearing it. The TSA regulation mandates masks should fit snugly but comfortably against the side of the face. So I'm going to ask a TSA agent next time I go through security. Uh-huh. You know, this is snug, but it's not comfortable. Where should I write my $1,500 check? To TSA? Can I just give it to you directly? And I was recently on a flight, and the beginning of the flight, the middle of the flight, the end of the flight was all
mask
some
police.
Air waitress telling me how much of a threat I'm under if I take my mask off to have the complimentary Chex Mix and don't put it back up after I'm done chewing a bite. It was really
disgusting.
It was really just annoying, but it's more than annoying because, of course, what's next? Not just the stiff fines for arbitrary enforcement of mask policy, you know, the details of which are unknowable, which means they're not the law. You also have this story to us. The mannequin from the men's department at the Macy's in Mishawaka, who's now the transportation secretary.
Our former intern at Channel 5, Pete.
Federal officials are considering whether to require airline passengers have negative coronavirus tests before boarding domestic flights. Proof of a negative test already required for passengers boarding international flights under a policy imposed by CDC. Mayor Pete told Axios over the weekend, there's an active conversation with CDC right now about whether to require a negative test for domestic travel as well. And then I would say, well, okay, that's okay. I'm just going to drive everywhere, but then I'm going to have to turn in my gas guzzler for some sort of electric smart car to even do that. I'm sure that will be next.
Well, and the airline said that that will destroy their already hurting industry. They agreed with the CDC and the FAA about international flights. You know, you should have a negative test before coming to this country, but they absolutely cannot have this going on.
No problem.
It is a problem.
No, it's not a problem because, number one, they're rent-seeking big business and they're shameful. Their conduct has been shameful to begin with. Number two, it's okay because they'll get bailed out. So we'll just crater your business and then we'll print some more funny money and we'll send you $40 or $50 billion, maybe $100 billion a year and a half from now. So, you know, you'll have to lay off a bunch of employees, but that's just regular people. Who cares? We'll make sure that your airline survive. We'll bail you out on the back end after we destroy on the front end. No problem.
That's what they're going to do, though. It's going to destroy the airlines industry. But then again, flying is not enjoyable at all because they're not flight attendants anymore. They're mask police. And I've been on two flights where they have turned the plane around because somebody refused to take their gator off and put on like one of those surgical masks. And then the other time, the guy wouldn't put it up over his nose properly, and they asked him two times, and then the captain came out, and they're like, we're turning around. It's so ridiculous. They have the HEPA filtration system in there. It's even safer than – it's as safe as a hospital, they say.
You have to share the delusion. You have to live in their make-believe world. You can't have a conversation about mask studies. This is religious in its ferocity, this mask business. And it's to keep you focused on mask wearing or even the discussion about mask wearing, although there's not much of a discussion that's allowed. You have to abide this make-believe or you're a bad person, so you focus on that and wear your mask and look, everybody, I'm a good person. And, meanwhile, they're printing another $2 trillion of money that your kids will have to pay back in some material form. Meanwhile, they're imposing these further strictures and draconian fines associated with enforcement. And meanwhile, they're making all sorts of other threats. And meanwhile, they're keeping your schools closed. And meanwhile, they're keeping your restaurants and your businesses closed. And meanwhile, they're moving a $15 minimum wage that's going to put your restaurant out of business. You know, while they've got you distracted being an orderly citizen in their brave new world, they're moving all these policies against you, your individual liberties, as I mentioned, as well as your economic interests. But no problem.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. If you want to move to Iowa, they just lifted their mask mandate there.
Ed and Glen Ellen.
In case you're wondering.
No, I'm amazed all the time at the double speak and talking out of both sides of people's mouths, and wonder when the American population say, wait a minute, you're telling me we have to wear a mask even if I get the vaccine, but if we get 70% then maybe we won't have to wear masks then. I mean, it's just the hypocrisy and the quote science behind it continues to amaze me and surprise me.
Thanks for the call. There's a good piece in City Journal by a former reporter for the Houston Chronicle called Science Betrayed. And he looks at the instruction of science at the K through 12 level. And he talks to researchers of all political stripes, left, right, libertarian. They all come to the same conclusion about how poor the science instruction is in classrooms and in K through 12 classrooms in America. And so here's the combination of what you have. You have the lack of science being taught at the K through 12 level. You're just producing generation after generation of people that have no concept of science so that they can be buffaloed by somebody who just repeats science as many times as possible. Science and data, and has a credential next to their name. That's like from Mount Sinai, according to some. That's the way they're treated. And then you have anybody who has the same credentials and actually did get an education in sciences and actually is a recognized scientist. I think immediately of John Ioannidis, the world-renowned epidemiologist out of Stanford. You have anybody like that starts to question the TV doctors and the government scientists, and they just get marginalized. They're relegated to places like the American Institute for Economic Research in terms of anybody who will listen to them, or people like, you know, hosts like us on this program who will listen to them based on the quality of their scholarship, based on the questions they're asking, based on the points they're making, rather than just their credential or their government sinecure. And so you have a world actually without science, and the more they say it, the less we rely on it, actually. Isn't that ironic?
Well, there is good news. I mean, the Times of Israel reported on their country's largest testing lab. They came out, vaccinated people are less likely to get COVID and less likely to transmit it.
Yeah, we already know that, and it doesn't matter. Jen Psaki said last week, you still have to wear masks, social distance, have to get vaccinated. Nothing will change so long as they can hold the line, and then we'll transition to the next pandemic or something akin to it, which, of course, is the climate apocalypse. And this is another area where even when you're Michael Moore, just talking about science in general, you get shut down. Michael Moore produced a documentary called Planet of Humans in 2019 that called into question, really called to the carpet, some of the policies that have been advanced by environmentalists in terms of alternative fuels, particularly biomass. And it was really a sort of devastating indictment of what environmentalists are saying about the potential of alternate energy sources, particular ones, versus what the reality is.
Yeah.
And how many people have seen Planet? This is Michael Moore. Why isn't this celebrated? Why isn't he on all these talk shows? He executive produced it. He wasn't the interviewer, the documentary on camera, but he executive produced it. Where is this driving our discussion or even included in the discussion about climate policy with the climate czar Kerry and his climate team? Nowhere.
Because it doesn't fit their narrative. Yeah.
Tim in Woodstock, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, I noticed Dr. Fauci mentioned he'd be happy he thinks when we've gotten 75% of people vaccinated. He didn't mention anything about people who've had the COVID virus already. And I was reading on the government's website that the immune systems of more than 95% of people who recovered from COVID had durable memories of the virus up to 8 months. And they're hoping that the virus, that the vaccine, excuse me, will give similar, you know, lasting immune memories, you know, after the vaccination. So if we're, you know, if people are getting this vaccination thinking that this is it, they're wrong. At least they're not sure at all at this point. And how long are we going to keep living like this until we're, you know, 100% sure that there's no threat? It's a ridiculous way to live our lives.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, and then they keep scaring us with the UK variant, the South African variant. Nobody knows. Nobody, I mean, because cases are down, hospitalizations are down across this country, down by 44%, folks, from where we were at the peak on November 2nd. And that, now they can't have to scare us with something else. They'll say it might be more deadly. It might be more lethal. It spreads quicker. But so, I mean, when is this about cases and not about hospitalizations and ICU?
One of President Trump's gravest errors in terms of lessons from COVID-19.
Yeah.
One of his gravest errors was platforming Tony Fauci. And personnel is policy. And I'll tell you what, one of my most enduring and consistent criticisms of President Trump was his personnel choices. Not all of them, clearly, but some of them, material ones that really negatively impacted his presidency and, frankly, his reelection. Mike in Union.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, you're absolutely right about Dr. Fauci. He's a disgrace. Did you notice that the WHO was finally allowed into China after more than a year, probably 18 months? All is well now. You know, it's an animal-to-animal transmission. This is all about the Chinese getting off the hook. And I would say follow the money. Yeah, it's a disgrace. And Dr. Fauci's right in there with them. So thanks guys. You have a great day.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Yeah, I'm just waiting for the announcement that Hunter Biden has been retained as a consultant for the WHO. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and impeachment trial 2.0 begins today. And I said, if you're not paying attention, you should be, because if you're a Trump voter, you're on trial. This is a trial more about you than it is President Trump. President Trump as a unifying figure for Democrats, thus their move to go forward with this futile effort, futile in the sense of there won't be a conviction, but not futile in the sense that there are political points to score. They think, and that's the basis for this, side by side, to understand the arguments being made, the positions being held. Jim Jordan, on the one side, explaining the GOP position, at least, minus 10 members of the caucus, GOP position on this impeachment.
The Constitution, the president wins. The lack of due process. I mean, this is Matt Gaetz said it best. This is impeachment by reflex. There was a 2-hour debate in the House. Yeah. At least what Adam Schiff did last year, at least there was actual hearings. They might have been done in the bunker in the basement of the Capitol, but there were subpoenas and depositions. I got to cross-examine witnesses. We had some actual hearings. So the Adam Schiff's impeachment looks great compared to this crazy thing, and we know how bad that one was. But the most important thing is the facts. The fact, you know, how do you incite a riot that was already planned? How do you incite a riot when the president said peacefully and patriotically, make your voices heard? So this is nothing but an obsession with the Democrats. It has been that way. Never forget, Judge, on January 20th, 2017, 19 minutes after the president took his oath of office, the Washington Post headline was campaign to impeach President Trump has begun. They couldn't even wait 20 minutes.
Judge, he was on Jeanine Pirro's show. That was the judge reference. And that's good, because you have to address the false story the make-believers are telling about January 6th, about Trump's role in January 6th. That has to be addressed straight away. But it's also not enough, because this is the left's perspective. as nicely encapsulated by Nicole Wallace on MSNBC, querying John Heilman about how McConnell and other Senate Republicans who criticize Trump can do anything but support his conviction. Listen to what she suggests.
We had a policy, and it was very controversial. It was carried out under the Bush years and under the Obama years, of attacking terrorism at its root, of going after and killing, and in the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American, a Yemeni American, with a drone strike for the crime of inciting violence, inciting terrorism. Mitch McConnell was in the Senate then. He was in the Senate after 9/11, too. How does Mitch McConnell, who understands that the way you root out terrorism is to take on, in the case of Islamic terrorism, kill those who incite it, how does he not vote to convict someone that he said on the floor of the Senate incited an insurrection?
Boy, it sounds like more than just vote to convict, doesn't it? Drone strikes to root out domestic terrorists in this country. Domestic drone strikes to combat violent extremism that the Biden administration is completely weaponized to focus upon. And, of course, violent extremist means largely Trump voter. They are in the business right now, the left is, of suppression or annihilation if you won't be suppressed. Suppression or annihilation. So while the argument on the merits of both the law as well as the facts is important in the context of the next week for this impeachment trial, the larger play that is being made, as has been articulated by Nicole Wallace and Chris Hayes at MSNBC, the Rachel Maddow lookalike, and Jake Tapper on CNN, and so many more, the LA Times columnist that we discussed yesterday, Virginia Heffernan, comparing Trump supporters to Nazis and Hezbollah terrorists. That is the bigger play being made by the left, and Republicans need to confront that straight away, too. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Boris Epstein. He is an attorney and former Trump campaign official. Boris, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
So the approach that the Trump legal team is telegraphed that it will choose to make over the next week is just basically focus on what Jim Jordan said sort of in progression. Today it's about the constitutionality of trying a president who's out of office, and then you move forward with the charge and the article of impeachment and the facts as we understand them and call the question.
Well, that's right. And there's three vectors here. The first vector is the fact that this is absolutely unconstitutional. The Constitution does not allow for a trial of an impeachment trial of a former president, and there's never been one. Number two, there was absolutely no incitement whatsoever. The president said, quote, march peacefully and patriotically to the Capitol. And three, the fact that discussing election fraud, voter fraud is absolutely allowable. It is absolutely legitimate. And this claim by the Democrats that any discussion, any claims of voter fraud, election fraud, or somehow a quote-unquote big lie, which is a term the Democrats are using that was coined by none other than the disgusting Adolf Hitler. Hitler claimed that the Jews used the quote-unquote big lie to discuss the German loss in World War I. Well, now you've got the Democrats saying, oh, the Republicans are just perpetrating the quote-unquote big lie. Well, guess what? Election fraud did happen. Voter fraud did happen. We know about the over 200,000 unlawful ballots in Wisconsin. There were counted, used against Wisconsin law and constitution. We know about the over 400,000 unlawful, allegedly unlawful ballots in Georgia. And guess what? Even Democrats, Mark Elias, the Democrat election lawyer, in his filing in the 22nd District of Congress in New York, 22nd Congressional District, said, oh, there was significant voting irregularities when he was opposing that result.
But do you agree that this venue, this impeachment trial, is not the venue to make those claims and to reissue those assertions? This is just about sort of the four corners of the article of impeachment, get his acquittal, and then he can go back to making whatever claims he sees fit to make.
Well, what I think is, and you know, the defense did put this in their brief is the fact that this election was suspect. There's a lot of parts of it that were suspect. And to claim otherwise, which the Democrats are doing, to say it was 100% clean, is just false. And I think we have to continue to stand strong on that.
Now, we learned yesterday that the Democrats are going to use, Facebook pictures, videos to prove their point about an alleged insurrection. But Trump's attorney said that they're going to fight back by showing clips of hateful rhetoric from Democrats, saying, get in their face, do what you can to make their life miserable. Do you think that's going to be effective?
I do. I think the Democrats are trying to paint this picture. I was on MSNBC actually yesterday in the evening, and they used the video montage of President Trump going back to 2015, 2016. Usually, most of the clips were from before he was president. And there's this claim, the president used tough language, and that's somehow outside the norm. But it's not outside the norm. Most of the senators sitting there as the jury in this trial have used that language. And it's going to be very tough then for them to say, we should still convict. Now, you still expect for the Democrats to not break ranks and vote against President Trump, and unfortunately for some Republicans to break ranks. But we now know from the vote on dismissal that there's not enough Republicans that will vote to convict for there to be a conviction. And this whole thing is just a total charade. It's a sham. And, it'll hopefully be over quickly, and the American people can move on to concentrating on their lives, to looking at what Joe Biden is doing to destroy America so quickly. 11,000 jobs lost just by the Keystone Pipeline being canceled, as an example. That's what we need to be worrying about. Our adversaries, China, Russia, Iran, not the charade.
I agree with that. Thinking, though, of the Trump campaign legal team's performance, the legal team that was assembled to challenge the election results from November 3rd to January 6th, I know you were an advisor in that mix. What do you think the lessons learned are? How could that have been more effective, the legal challenges to the outcomes in the relevant states?
I think the lessons, Dan, are that we have to fight now. We have to be strong now on these election rules. We have to go and continue pointing out the deep violations of Article 2 of the Constitution that occurred, where you didn't have state legislatures, but state secretaries of state, governors, judges, changing election rules. The consent decree in Georgia. Again, the changed rules in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, the changed rules around observing of mail-in and absentee ballots. All of that is a violation of Article 2 of the Constitution, which allows only for state legislatures to set rules around presidential voting. So we have to be in court. We have to be in the court of public opinion, fighting back against those violations now to make sure they don't happen again in 22 and 24.
He is Boris Epstein. He's an attorney. He's also a former Trump campaign official. Boris, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I'm a staunch supporter of Joe Biden and voted for him to save this country, writes Betsy LeRoy. She is the proprietor of Pizza by Elizabeth's, just outside of Wilmington, Delaware. Mm. Staunch supporter of Joe Biden, voted for him to save this country. Problem is, his policies won't allow her to save her business. This president and his team may understand Delaware politics, but I'm not sure they understand the difficulties of Delaware restaurants. How else to explain his proposal to raise the minimum wage for our servers and bartenders from $2.23 an hour to $15 an hour, an increase of more than 400%, which would be a death knell for our industry. And she, writing in the Wall Street Journal, is urging Joe Biden to be something he's not, a leader, moderate. Maybe this is a cautionary tale, and I don't mean to pile on, but I mean, to some extent, Betsy LeRoy, maybe she is a cautionary tale for people who make political decisions based on personality rather than on policy. I voted for him to save this country, but I guess my business is going to have to be sacrificed. I suppose she wasn't ready for that. I don't know how she could have missed it. I don't know how she could have missed that a Biden administration would be Bolshevik Bernie staffers implementing Obama policies, as we're seeing play out in real time. Obama staffers implementing Bolshevik Bernie policies, as we're seeing play out in real time. How is that unclear? Do you think they care that the CBO projects a $15 minimum wage mandate would cost 1.4 million jobs? You're going to have to spill a little blood to create heaven on earth, as all authoritarians say. Oh, and by the way, this job loss that has occurred and continues to.
Yeah.
Remember how 2008, 2009, the Great Recession was a man session? This is the opposite. Carol Markowitz had a good piece in the New York Post talking about this, where the feminists. The National Women's Center noted that the December jobs numbers, 140,000 jobs lost, it was 156,000 jobs that women lost, while men actually gained 16,000 jobs in November.
Yeah, because women have to stay home and teach their children.
Well, this is exactly her point. Even, writes Markowitz, even more female workers may have felt forced to voluntarily, quote unquote, give up their jobs to be home looking after kids exiled from their school buildings at the behest of the powerful teachers' unions. Oh, and as CNN reports, the job losses hit Black and Hispanic women disproportionately. Feminists are supposed to care about minorities along with women, aren't they?
Yeah.
Confusing times. Among those confused is Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary. She had this exchange with Fox News' Peter Doocy, continued exchange over the cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline with other pipelines in the crosshairs. And those 11,000 jobs that have reportedly been lost, those green jobs that are coding jobs that those people are going to have access to, when do those come online?
When is it that the Biden administration is going to let the thousands of fossil fuel industry workers, whether it's pipeline workers or construction workers, who are either out of work or will soon be out of work because of a Biden EO, when it is and where it is that they can go for their green job? And that is something the administration has promised. There is now a gap. So I'm just curious when that happens, when those people can count on that.
Well, I'd certainly welcome you to present your data of all the thousands and thousands of people who won't be getting a green job. Maybe next time you're here, present that.
But you said that they would be getting green jobs, so I'm just asking when that happens. Richard Trumka, who is a friend, longtime friend of Joe Biden, says about that day one Keystone EO, he says, I wish he, the president, had paired that more carefully with the thing that he did second by saying, here's where we are creating the jobs. So there's partial evidence from Richard Trumka.
Well, you didn't include all of his interview. Would you like to include the rest?
So how about this? The Laborers International Union of North America said the Keystone decision will cost 1,000 existing union jobs and 10,000 projected construction jobs.
Well, what Mr. Trumka also indicated in the same interview was that President Biden has proposed a climate plan with transformative investments in infrastructure and laid out a plan that will not only create millions of good union jobs, but also help tackle the climate crisis. And as the president has indicated, when he gave his primetime address to talk about the American Rescue Plan, he talked about his plans to also put forward a jobs plan in the weeks or months following. And he has every plan to do exactly that.
What's the big deal? You lost your job yesterday. President Biden is going to get around to proposing a jobs plan in the weeks or months to come. You know, again, there's going to be a little blood spilled when you're creating heaven on earth. So just chill out, man.
So snarky and dismissive. I can't stand her.
She's also an idiot. Ugh. What does that mean? Present my evidence about the jobs are not going to get. I'm asking you when they're going to get jobs. It's just idiotic, by the way.
And where do they apply, woman?
AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka sat down with some fungible reporter for Axios and was asked about this. Here's Trumka on the Keystone Pipeline cancellation.
Can you explain why the president was right?
Well, I wish he hadn't done that on the first day, because the Laborers International was right. It did and will cost us jobs in the process. I wish he had paired that more carefully with the thing that he did second, by saying, here's where we're creating jobs. We can do mine reclamation, we can fix leaks, and we can fix seeps and create hundreds of thousands of jobs in doing all of that stuff.
You think Biden realizes that that was a mistake, that announcement?
I think so, yes.
Did you talk to him about it?
I have not.
Talk to him about it.
I think he thinks it was a mistake. No, he doesn't. And it doesn't matter what he thinks. Trumka on how it's going to change going forward. This is, you know, sort of great political interference Trumka is running for Biden at present.
I don't know. I know this. If he does, he'll pair it with job creation. That will be greater than the number of jobs lost.
That's if he cancels more pipelines. So, right, that's what's going to happen next time, because he's learned his lesson, according to Trumka, who hasn't talked to him. And the way that you pair it is by killing actual jobs and then, you know, some weeks or months down the road, proposing a package that would ostensibly, maybe, possibly create other jobs to backfill the jobs that you killed that may or may not be available to the job holders that you unemployed through your policy. I mean, this is, you know, just all, everything is government centric here. Government takes, government gives back. You got to wait. You're on the sidelines. You vote. You say, vote for me to save the world. And you sacrifice your business on the altar of me saving the world, like that woman in Delaware. I hope these are cautionary tales. I doubt so many on the left who are completely fear addled and agitprop laden will, but one can hope. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined again by David Harsanyi, who is a reporter or a columnist for National Review. He's also a author. He wrote the book First Freedom, America's Enduring History with the Gun. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
So just on the minimum wage, which I know the report is that it's not going to make the $2 trillion in funny money scheduled to be spent, but they'll wait for a later point in time where it's more politically advantageous to serve up that populist grist for the mill.
Right. And it's interesting you were talking about the pipeline as well. I think the minimum wage and things like this, where voters hear something they like, it's populist, feels good. They feel like they really have no cost to pay. It's not even a tax increase or anything, just forcing greedy businesses to give people more money. Sounds good, feels good. But then when people start implementing those plans, you realize that the policies themselves are quite destructive, especially, I mean, both actually. But the minimum wage obviously is just a job killer. But more than that, it affects poor places more than rich places, where most people make $50 an hour anyway, like New York City. But in West Virginia or Nebraska or somewhere else, you're destroying restaurants and businesses of that nature. It's also a barrier for jobs. Yeah.
Yeah. And just one thing on that, too, because I think people listen to this. We've had this fight over the minimum wage every time it's been raised over the many years. And now we're at 15. And so, we raised it and nothing happened. Everything just went on their merry way and people forgot about it. It was fine. Well, it wasn't fine. And, you know, it's the seen versus the unseen. And the authoritarian always counts on people to pay no attention to the unseen or not connect dots so they see what is apparently unseen. And that is things like you were just describing. In poor areas, it's a barrier to job creation. And so the poor areas of big urban centers or rural areas never get less poor, because the barriers to creating a job, employing people, continue to get beyond what the market will provide. And so this is one of the reasons, not the only reason, not the only bad policy, but one of the policies that perpetuates poverty.
Right. Most, I think 58% of people who make minimum wage, wherever they are young people who probably work in, you know, in a fast food place or wherever. It's not a lifetime job, and it's not a sort of static group. These are people passing through. But when you lift the wage, you create a barrier for people getting into that flow. So it's like people just can't understand, because it feels good, that the minimum wage is zero, as Thomas Sowell said, and that is the real minimum wage, and that's the wage that you create for people who won't be getting jobs in the future. As you say, it's just not something people see.
Oh. Yeah. Well, it's not only that, too, but if you have full-time employment, you have to split the hours then with other employees because they can't afford.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a real problem, too, that no one discusses.
Oh, or it's a tax on consumers, basically, who now will not spend their money elsewhere and create new jobs in the different areas of the economy.
I thought the piece that Carol Markowitz wrote in the Post was really good, too, just focusing in on, you know, who you say you represent and then who's getting punished the most by your lockdown or policies. And the the stones on these lockdowning governors and mayors to be decrying the unemployment and the economic devastation that the pandemic has wrought is really something to behold. But this is, their real skill set is getting people to share in their delusions.
Yeah, and on that topic, I mean, sometimes it's just so hard for me to believe when I see people basically celebrating lockdowns, to, you know, politicians talking about it in patriotic terms, of how easily large numbers of people have just taken to it and listen and don't push back against its authoritarianism. I mean, I don't know if you saw the Tampa Bay mayor, I think, said of the people celebrating outside that the police would track them down and identify them.
Yeah.
I mean, can't even believe people speak this way, right? And, of course, the lockdowns themselves are the worst because you're destroying the economy and then people will have to rely more and more on government, which, frankly, I think a lot of people are in some sense happy about.
And you know what, Mayor Castro, she should turn herself in, because what's going around the internet right now is her at the Super Bowl, guess what, without a mask on.
They do that all the time, right? I mean, it's happened,
it wasn't even
so
on her
many
chin,
times.
It's gone.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it just from the California governor to, you know, to all over the place, you see these people in power who are just ruling by fiat. I mean, it's unilaterally telling you can't go to church, you can't go to work, you can't do this, you can't do that. There's no debate over it. There's no real legislation over it. And it's just authoritarianism. I don't care if there's a pandemic. You know, it reminds me of like Roman dictators in the Republic era where, you know, they'd have all the power for a year and no one would question it. That's not how we built this country.
Interesting. The Tampa story we mentioned earlier, Ron DeSantis signed an executive order back in September prohibiting municipalities from imposing fines or penalties for not wearing masks. So you can have a mask requirement in Tampa Bay or wherever, whatever, on the other community, but you can't impose penalties. So the Tampa mayor may be bloviating to curry favor with the press corps, but she runs into Ron DeSantis, who, of course, has been treated as the worst person in the Western world.
Yeah, and he's done a pretty good job down there. And the mask thing, you know, I wrote about this, I have a piece coming out soon, and I just feel like I've made a big turn on it. I feel it's really, you know, the government should have no power to tell people to wear masks in the street. In their buildings, fine. And if the Target wants to make me wear a mask, that's fine as well. But this just, these just diktats about masks, which are, in, you know, people treat as a patriotic piece of cloth as well. It's just so disconcerting for me because I find them dehumanizing, frankly, in many ways. I'm not like some anti-masker. If you want me to wear a mask, I will. But I just, it's obviously not been, it's not stopped what's happening in any real way. And I worry about the authoritarian instincts of these people who just can tell me to put a piece of clothing on. I sound
David,
a little like a wacko,
well, God,
but, you
yeah.
know.
Well, if God wanted to us to be safe, he would have created us with masks on our face or a beak of some sort. Because
right.
now people aren't wearing masks. Now, I saw a guy yesterday, he had three masks on. Like, what?
Oh,
God, I see we're in full
so
panic
mad.
Mode. Hello?
Living in fear all the time is not healthy, and that's what we're doing right now.
And with respect to the impeachment, before we let you go, Trump is going to be acquitted again. He'll have that second acquittal in his back pocket. What would you recommend that he do coming out of that acquittal? Should we revisit some of these election issues, at least not maybe in the context of relitigating the 2020 election, but in the context of putting pressure on state legislatures in particular states to tighten up their election law, tighten up their election laws, particularly as you see the Senate and House Democrats going all in to federalize what happened in 2020. So it is the permanent norm for elections, presidential elections, federal elections going forward.
Yeah, I'm totally opposed to any sort of federalizing of elections. I want to make voting harder, not easier. Sorry to say. I mean, I'm not sorry to say. I think this just mail-in voting where they just send out ballots to everyone. At the very least, you should have to request one, I think. But states should make up their own minds, and some already run good elections. What I worried about is the places that, like Michigan and elsewhere, which are maybe in play, you have Democrats, I think, running things, and it's going to be very difficult to fix that. But I think the Republicans should be enticed by any sort of national, answer to that to that problem. I think they should just keep working on the states, et cetera. So. But Democrats have quite a bit of power right now, so we'll see what happens.
And what about, Molly Ball's piece in Time that everybody's talking about? We talked about a bit yesterday, the secret campaign and these members of the Illuminati that were pulled together to make sure everybody understood that anything that happened, no matter what it looked like, was legitimate, and preparing people that the election returns may not all come in on election night as we're used to because of these unprecedented times and so on and so forth. And how effective, frankly, the secret campaign that was cobbled together under the auspices of making sure everybody knew everything was on the up and up, which is why you do things in secret, to make sure everybody knows it's on the up and up. Okay. But one of the key takeaways I had was this solution to pressure platforms to enforce their rules, remove content, accounts that spread disinformation, as those complaining so define it, and be more aggressive policing content in the first place. This was a way to prevent social media platforms from having the same utility for Trump and ostensibly for Republicans in 2020 that it had for him in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, I thought some of that piece was a little bit overblown with, in the sense of being this concerted effort by the left. I mean, there is a concerted effort, and that's how politics are. And I think that Republicans just need to do a better job, as they did. Though the social media aspect of it is constantly worrying me, and I really don't have answers for it. I mean, I think once you let government decide what fairness looks like, or who should be on a site, or who should be able to speak, first of all, it's going to be turned on you sooner or later. But more than that, as a principle, I don't think it's a good idea. So I don't have very good answers for that. When I tell people they should build their own sites, they laugh at me. But I mean, that seems to be the way forward in the long term, to build your own institutions, your own news organizations, because we don't have very many left, and your own websites and things like that. I'm not sure how else to deal with it. Yeah.
And we better get to it in a hurry. Otherwise, by the time it turns on them, we'll be too late. There's nobody left to leverage that turning. David Harsanyi, senior writer for National Review, author of First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, From the Revolution to Today. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out.
Bum, bum, bum.
I said, when you're moving out.
That song means it's time for our weekly hit with Ted Dabrowski, president of wirepoints.org, where you go for great research and commentary and all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. One of the guys not moving out, Ted Dabrowski.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I'm still here.
Yes, you're still here.
Any plans, though, to move?
No, no plans. I like it here. We're going to fight.
Lash to the masts, Ted Dabrowski. Yeah. Okay, so Ted, $1.9 trillion in funny money from the feds. That seems to be imminent. The disbursement to take some time, but included in that will be some level of bailout money for states generally and terribly run states like Illinois specifically. Why would we and why would you oppose Illinois getting whatever it can get from the federal government, our tax dollars back?
Yeah, well, you know, we've been doing research at Wire Points on this, and you're starting to hear a lot of commentary from economists on both sides of the aisle. You've got Larry Summers, which was Clinton's Secretary of Treasury, and, of course, people on the right saying, hey, wait a minute, we don't really need this money. Have you not looked at the numbers lately? So at Wire Points, we've started to compile all the numbers state by state, looking at the revenue numbers that they had before COVID, looking at the reserves states had. We're looking at the amount of money they got from the CARES Act. And when you start to look at everything and also taking into account that 2020 for a calendar year wasn't nearly as bad as people thought it would be, suddenly you realize that there's just not a need for that money. Even the blue states like California far outperformed those dire projections that came out back in April and May. So you've got California doing better. They actually had more revenues in 2020 tax revenues than in 2019. And a place like Illinois only came up about 1% short. So all the numbers, just not needed.
Well, but we're 1% short of projections. Okay, fine. But, I mean, we have, you know, $250, $300 billion in aggregate debt and about $30 billion in assets. That's a problem. So why don't we just take what we can get?
Well, yeah, now you're hitting a different point, right? So in theory, right, Biden's blue state bailout is supposed to be for COVID issues. But when you strip back the COVID issues, you'll see that most states are doing well, and what's left is the pre-pandemic mess. And that's the real problem, is places like New Jersey, Connecticut, and Illinois, who survived the pandemic relatively well, and I'm speaking in relative terms, especially when you take into account reserves for some states and CARES Act for others. They don't need the money. What they need the money for is a bailout of their pension mess, of their mismanagement, of their, you know, just gross governance.
Yeah, semantics, right? What's the big deal? Let's take whatever money we can. If we had Mexican drug cartels give us money, we should take it. Why don't we take money wherever we can get money, right?
Well, that's what's happening with everybody, right? If you get a stimulus check, people are taking it whether they need it or not, and a lot of people are getting it. And this is what happens in this environment. Money just starts flowing out of nowhere. It was the case back with Obama. It was Obama money. That's what they called it, Obama money. And now it's going to be Biden money. And, of course, it was Trump money as well. So when this money starts to flow, we lose sight of what, you know, real finances look like. And that's why economists on both sides are starting to warn, wait a minute, we could blow up this economy in the wrong way because we're starting to grow again. It's fascinating. The bottom quintile in 2020 got transfer payments of $45,000 annually. So you're talking about a massive transfer of money, and that's why spending has been strong. That's frankly why the money's not needed.
Well, and then you have governors like Kristi Noem, and I don't know if there's others that, you know, their state has a budget surplus, so they're sending back the money. They're not accepting it.
Well, and it makes sense, right? I mean, in theory, but to Dan's point, there's a lot of takers now, and they'll take the money no matter what.
J.B. Pritzker will send dessert back before he sends that money from D.C. back.
Hey-o. Yes, that's true.
And why shouldn't he, right? I mean, what's the downside for Illinois to take money from wherever he is? If Kristi Noem wants to send her money that South Dakota is scheduled to get to Illinois, we'll take that too. I mean, I guess my question is, you know, why shouldn't they? Why would anybody oppose Illinois doing that?
Well, they won't. They won't. And the thing is that, you know, this money is distributed on a proportional basis based on population. So, you know, it behooves every state to say, well, hey, we're going to have to pay for it later in higher taxes or whatever it is. We might as well take the money now. And there's no doubt that Pritzker would just take every penny of this. Don't forget, somebody like Lightfoot will take it too. She, the state has been spending more and more money at CPS, with the raises they've given at CPS. Pritzker gave AFSCME big raises last year. So, yeah, they need the money. They want the money.
And the point here is, you mentioned the transfer payments to the lowest quintile. This is to make everybody comfortable so they are, you know, happy enough to wallow in their current state, whether it's restrictions on their freedom or economic or individual. They just, you know, relatively comfort. They're relatively taken care of by the government. So, you know, there's no need to get ornery with the status quo.
Well, this is the problem, right, is that people don't realize that it's just doing damage, right? It's just like, it's like a drug. You take it, you enjoy it, but you don't realize what harm it's doing you. And it's not just the bailout, right? They want to. I don't think they'll be successful, but they want to put a $15 minimum wage into this bill. And, you know, imagine making – you're not just making Seattle and all those places pay $15, although they're happy to do it. You're making Carmi and you know, Carbondale and other places pay $15 $15 an hour for costs they could never afford. You know, Carmi can't afford to pay $15 an hour to somebody for a sandwich shop. No way.
Right, and obviously even within those enlightened urban centers, there's businesses that are differently situated. It's easy for Amazon, not so easy for, you know, the corner diner. Let me ask you about it, about the only issue that actually is interesting to me at all in Illinois, and that is the opportunity scholarships, the tax credit scholarship program. So this, once it was passed and signed into law by Governor Rauner, has that five-year horizon, five-year sunset. But it's in the crosshairs of the teachers' unions and the Marxists in Springfield every year. And so your assessment on the ongoing establishment of the tax credit scholarship program, are we getting to where there's a big enough constituency, enough kids and families benefiting, that it's going to be difficult even by politicians who are beholden to the teachers' unions to undo it?
Well, I want to think that yes. And the reason why is because you've had, you know, a lot of minority kids benefit from this. You know, this Empower Illinois and other groups that have helped this the scholarship become a reality. It's really helping a lot of kids get out of the CPS, and we know there's 1,000 reasons why they should get out of CPS and go to the Catholic schools or other private schools. But I want to say that we might have reached critical mass. It's always in doubt, of course, in Illinois, right? The power of the unions to break these kind of things is strong, but they haven't broken it yet, right? And this is Rauner's, you know, maybe Rauner's only good achievement when he was in office, and you know, they've had, you know, a couple years to break it, to unwind it, and they failed. And part of that is because I think, you know, a decent amount of the Black community, some of the Black legislators, and certainly the Hispanic legislators, know there's a lot of value to giving kids a choice. You know, this is empowering parents, empowering Hispanic and minority parents for the first time in this state and in Chicago in a long, long time. It's one of the few good things left.
What about the reopening of businesses, the reopening of schools going on, mainly in Chicago, because Chicago is the laggard? Your assessment of the sort of damage that has been done, that will continue to be done, perhaps in smaller doses, but damage nonetheless, and the amount of recovery time you're looking at for the city center, for example.
Well, just, you know, speaking of. You know, giving kids school choice, right? It's been disastrous for the kids at CPS who've been out of school for a year, pretty much.
332 days, but I'm not counting.
You're not counting,
no.
Yes. Uh-uh. And you're talking about, you know, over 300,000 kids. It's been disastrous. And what's sad about this is that you can count on your hands the number of kids under the age of 17 who've died from COVID. It's four. Mm. And those are sad, but that's the reality. And then you know, when you count the number of adults under the age of 50 who've died without comorbidities, it's really, you know, in relative terms, a small number, and yet we've destroyed a lot of kids and a lot of families' livelihoods. So I don't think this new CTU deal has done any good. Maybe kids will be in class in March, maybe.
Well,
it's summertime again.
Yeah, and it's 20%, only that. It's 70,000 kids signed up, that which is nothing. And, folks, this isn't a Monday through Friday thing. This is just hybrid learning 2 days a week. That's what we're fighting for.
Well, Amy, what's horrible about all this, and, you know, Dan, you've touched on this too, is the press has made a disaster of you know, the fear mongering. You know, I saw a sign of a teacher, you know, wearing her red shirt and saying, you know, they're trying to kill my kids or something like that. And you know, that's it's fear. And when you play that out all over the place, it's really hard for families to say, oh yeah, I'll go back in tomorrow. And let me just remind you, you're asking about the statewide. a place like Deerfield, right? Deerfield is, I think they spend whatever it is, the 10th most in the state on a per student basis to teach. And they have not been in class either since March of last year. So it's across the board, right? A struggling, failing school like CPS and a highly successful one like Deerfield and Highland Park.
Well, no, psychosis is not bounded by geography. There's no question. You know, I'm a nattering nabob of negativism when it comes to Illinois. I'm not as optimistic as I should be, according to some. So you're more optimistic than I am. You're happy-go-lucky kind of sort, Ted. So, you know, tell me and our listeners something to look forward to. What's on the horizon that's good news, that's a good initiative, that's a positive movement? Give us something to grab onto, those still lashed to the mast with you in Illinois.
Yeah, so Dan, let me just slightly change what you're saying. I'm optimistic once the you know what hits the fan. So I'm not optimistic that we're going to turn this thing around tomorrow, because you know, our new leadership isn't going to do anything new. Lori Lightfoot isn't going to do anything constructive. It's so far everything I see is destructive. Where I'm optimistic is that the math at some point won't work anymore, and you know how this thing falls apart. And I don't want to see it fall apart, right? I would dream of seeing suddenly everybody become reformers and we fix everything tomorrow. It's not going to happen. But I do think that sometime, at some point, the math stops working, and that's when finally we have a chance at reforms, because there won't be any other choice. If the place is bankrupt, they'll have to do something new. So that's kind of the perspective we take on it.
So when does that watershed moment happen, you know, within a range? I mean, the way I read the filings from the police and fire pension systems in Chicago, Chicago Police Pension Fund will be the first to capsize, and that is potentially, you know, months in the offing, or maybe a little over a year in the offing, if there is not some deus ex machina infusion of cash into that fund. Firefighters are right behind. I mean, they're both less than 25% funded, and this is in a relatively robust market. We'll see if there's a downturn in 21. I mean, in 22, more likely than 21. But for you, you know, there's a lot of people in the center right have been talking about the math, and myself included. The math doesn't work, and the math doesn't work. It is inexorable, but it's hard to pinpoint it. And, you know, people sort of holding on for the best scenario, which was be structural reform, which is not going to happen, or the second or the best scenario, I guess, is the system to fall under its own weight so that it can be reformed in that way, because it needs to be reformed ultimately. And if you're not going to take the stairs, then I guess you have to take the window. But you know, it just, that's been said for a decade, politicians, Republican politicians, for almost decades now, plural. And so when do you see something like that, unfortunately, a pension fund capsizing, for example, happening that would really usher a moment of clarity into the political and policy arena?
Well, Dan, you're right that, you know, we've been warning about this danger of a financial collapse for some time. But I think we've always underestimated, stupidly, the power of Madigan and others to find the next can kick over and over and over. They always found it. But what's interesting about today versus 10 years ago is that the number of options for can kicks are gone. And what's fascinating about today is that everybody's looking at Illinois now. Now, unfortunately, we have a Biden administration that would be supportive of bailouts of some kind. But the rating agencies are looking at Illinois. We're the national outlier. We're the extreme one. And so the number of can kicks available to Welch and his team are almost zero, right? They couldn't even get the tax hike done. They'll come for another one. But the games they can play with not funding pensions and doing things like that, they're over. And so if you look at today's world, there's two things that are different. The finances are absolutely out of control. Pritzker and those guys, they don't have control of the finances. The outside market does. The bond market has control of the finances, and the federal government has control of Illinois' finances. Illinois does not have its own control. Number two, record out migration. Unless they build a wall around Illinois, people will continue to leave, and others won't come in. And those two factors right there are the ones that have changed the dynamics between a decade ago and today. And depending on how fast those things move, will determine how quickly Illinois runs out of cash and is forced to do something different.
Ted Dabrowski, president at Wirepoints, wirepoints.org. Ted, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I really enjoy this piece by Don Boudreau, who I always enjoy, over at the American Institute for Economic Research. Boudreau runs the Mercatus Center, George Mason University, noted economist. My incessant wondering, what I wonder about. My incessant wondering about COVID is about why people don't wonder. My incessant wondering about COVID is instead about what other people think or refuse to think about COVID. The other people being those who, after reading this piece, will accuse me of being either appallingly selfish or inexcusably unaware that the coronavirus spreads through humans coming into close physical proximity to each other. Here's a feature of COVID I incessantly wonder about. What's so special about this communicable and dangerous disease that causes humanity to treat it as differing categorically from the countless other communicable and dangerous diseases that we regard with utter blaseness? It won't do to answer that COVID's lethality is higher than normal. Such an answer, strictly speaking, implies that lockdowns, masks, social distancing, all the other arbitrary excesses of massive government powers and antisocial behaviors that are justified as necessary to fight COVID-19 become appropriate the moment we encounter a disease that is even slightly more more dangerous than quote-unquote normal. How much higher than normal must rise the lethality of a communicable pathogen in order to justify the sort of wholesale rearrangement of human existence and crushing of human freedom that we've suffered over the past 11 months? Things he wonders about. To borrow from Arsenio Hall, Once Upon a Time, things that make you go, But why? But I love the question. Here are the things I wonder about, writes Boudreau. I have questions. His overriding question is, why don't other people have those same questions?
Because they're going along to get along. They think that there's some greater good out there. And government, really, again, there's a lot of people who don't have God or church in their lives, and they put their trust and faith in government. And so if government says, oh, you should hunker down, you should stay inside your house, think of COVID as an army out there trying to get you. You wouldn't remember when Dr. Nzike said that? He said you wouldn't really care about getting your dog groomed or going to work if there's soldiers outside trying to attack you. And that kind of mindset, that is indelibly etched into a lot of Chicagoans' minds, and that's why they're doing what they're doing. And they do the half moon around you, or they zigzag, and they don't talk to your neighbors anymore because, my God, you could get the COVID. It's ridiculous.
Right. We have a wartime president, and we're all doing our part to aid the war effort. Uh-huh. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Tom Woods, New York Times bestselling author, senior fellow at the Mises Institute, host of The Tom Woods Show, and author of The Politically Incorrect Guide, author of Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown, A Non-Hysterical Guide to COVID-19. Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown, A Hysterical Guide to COVID-19. Your Facebook friends are wrong about the lockdown piece is what I really enjoy. I love the sarcasm. Tom, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
So I didn't realize that my Facebook friends were not all noted epidemiologists.
You know, I have built up a little bit of a brand now, coming up with free ebooks called Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Blank. It works for everything, Dan. Every topic you can think of, whether it's guns or healthcare, whatever. And the thing is, I know we curate our Facebook friends, and we know most of them because maybe we meet them at conferences or whatever. But we have our high school friends who, for some reason, despite all the hundreds of intelligent posts we've put up there over the years, they're still stuck in their old conventional views. It's like we've posted nothing. Has it all been in vain? So I've released these e-books.
I got to start because I perused your ebook. I got to start with Tony Fauci, who is you know, been canonized by the political class throughout this. And he was on with Bret Baier yesterday saying, you know, the mask wearing, for example, that's going to have to continue on until and unless there is no identifiable shard of COVID-19 still circulating in the Western world. And so it just persists. And this is the new storyline we're seeing pop up, not just Fauci, who seems to be sort of a spokesperson for the lockdowner crowd, but in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere. Hey, just because you got vaccinated doesn't mean you don't have to wear a mask and you still got a social distance. Hey, keep wearing the mask even when you get to herd immunity. Hey, this is going to go on forever.
Well, Fauci, you know, I had on my program a fellow you should look into talking to. I love this guy, Jay Bhattacharya. He's a professor at Stanford.
We've had him on, sure.
Oh, have you? Okay. What's great about him is that, I mean, I can't speak for you guys, but I, when I talk about this, I get kind of a hot head and maybe I lose my temper a bit because this is such an atrocity that's been carried out on us. And people are just sitting back accepting it like it's normal, and I just can't stay calm and reasonable. He is so calm and reasonable. He's like the medical equivalent of Perry Como, you know, super soothing and calm. I love this guy. And I add him on, and I asked him just flat out, I'm going to ask you to say something about the canonized saint of this whole fiasco, namely Anthony Fauci. What do you think about him? And he was very blunt with me. He said, look, I have a book on my shelf co-edited by Anthony Fauci. I know he is a credentialed expert on some things, but he's not omniscient on every conceivable field, among them balancing costs and benefits when it comes to policies like this. And he says, look, Fauci's been bad on schools. We've known the research on schools since there was a contact tracing study in April in Iceland. We knew right away that schools were not a source of spread, and he's been spreading panic about that. He had this ridiculously embarrassing exchange with Rand Paul about there not being any – he didn't know about T-cell immunity or pre-existing immunity to these to this virus among some people, but there's plenty of research on that. I think it wasn't until September or possibly even October – before he finally acknowledged there might be some side effects to lockdown. There might be some collateral damage. Oh, you don't say. Even the New York Times, I mean, when the New York Times admits something, you know it's overwhelming. They have no choice. The New York Times pointed out some time ago that over the next several years, there are going to be more than 2 million excess deaths from tuberculosis, HIV, and malaria because of missed health services because of the lockdowns. Now, that's millions of people. This is not even – no one's even bothering to point that out because they're monomaniacally fixated on one thing.
Fauci, it went unnoticed by him when 40 million people were suddenly unemployed spring of last year?
No. I mean, somebody did ask him once, and this was reported in the Wall Street Journal, are you factoring in collateral damage from lockdown? He said no. Because his view was that's not his role. I'm a medical professional. I'm supposed to tell you how to go after this virus. Okay. I mean, I suppose maybe that is partly his job. But the real question is going after one virus, should that be our society's goal? Well, there's no scientist who's trained to answer that question. That's just superstition to think that. That's a philosophical question that we have to answer. We have to balance a lot of costs and benefits here. You could save some lives possibly from the virus, but you're going to lose lives in other ways, and you're going to destroy the very reason we're alive in the first place. If living was just a matter of biological existence, then I guess we should all be perfectly satisfied to sit in a windowless room eating cans of navy beans for 75 years. But this is not fulfilling. This is not why we're here.
A physicist who listens to our show sent an email this morning that I really like. I think he really encapsulated how science is, what science education has become at the K-12 level, but also now, you know, that spills out into social media and the other places that you were discussing. He writes, science education has become little more than a computer-generated magic show intermixed with some live tricks. The underlying theory is sometimes taught and always absent the hands-on experience of working with equipment and the errors of measurement. Science is taught as absolute knowledge rather than as a process of theory and measurement and debate. And, you know, Tony Fauci, these TV doctors, they would do the nation a service to maybe take a step back at some point and explain to people what science is and what it is not. It is not absolute knowledge. It's what this physicist who wrote to us says it is, a process of theory and measurement and debate.
Which is what we have sadly lacked. I remember early on in this, there was some doctor in New York who just made an amateur YouTube video saying, look, the ventilators that everybody that Andrew Cuomo says we need 40,000 of, which was laughable. They wound up getting a fraction of that. And even that, they gave some of them away to other states. He said the ventilators are making the situation worse. Now, of course, that wasn't, quote, the science of the time. That was a dissenting voice. But thank goodness some people listened to that dissenting voice, because it turns out the ventilators were a problem and people were being put on them much too readily. And that was not helping. Thank goodness we had a dissenting voice. I mean, these days, people think you're not listening to the science if you don't – what? If I don't accept some article that you read in some magazine 5 minutes ago? What I care about – I mean, I'm a doctor in the Jill Biden sense. You know, I have a PhD. I don't have an MD, okay? But as a PhD, though, I can read charts, okay? I'm not an epidemiologist, although I've talked to a lot of them, and they agree with me. I can read charts. And I look at things like North Dakota and South Dakota, both had a spike in November. And South Dakota stayed laissez-faire, no state-imposed restrictions. North Dakota imposed restrictions, same curve. And I could look at North Carolina, Oklahoma, different policies, same curve. And this goes again and again and again. Or California. California's got one of the youngest populations in the country. My state, Florida, has one of the oldest. So we should be getting devastated by this compared to California. California's locked down and they're, quote unquote, listening to the science. By the way, there was no science of lockdown till 2020. There is no such thing. And it turns out that now not only is Florida doing better today in terms of deaths, hospitalizations, whatever, but even overall since the thing began, California is now inching up to Florida, because California's at about 1,180 per million and Florida's at like 1,290 per million in terms of death. That's a trivial difference. That's more than accounted for by the age difference of the population. And California has ruined everybody's life for almost a year. Yeah. At some point, you have to sit back and say, is this doing any good? Or is it just voodoo that they don't dare back off from, because then they'd have to admit they ruined our lives for nothing?
Well, what about the mental health aspect of this, and especially our children? I know here in Illinois, we've had five quote-unquote COVID deaths. They all had comorbidities, and there's three you know, toxicology reports still out on three others who possibly could have died from complications due to COVID. But we've had 40-plus suicides, and most of them were just it's the isolation of it all. I mean, we haven't been in school in 331 days, have not stepped foot in my kids' high school in that long.
Yeah.
And we weren't built to do this.
I don't know if you saw in Nevada – they accelerated the school reopening because of a spate of suicides. Like I have to say it was dumb of them to close the schools, but at least we have some people in the country who evaluate evidence and act on the basis of the evidence. Yep. That this is actually hurting people. We should stop doing it. Now, by the way, so I did write your Facebook friends are wrong about the lockdown. So I made it because thanks to my kids, I know how to do technology. I made it. It makes me seem like a wizard, but it's really just them teaching me behind the curtain. It's the kids running things. Yeah. But if you text the word lockdown to the number 33444, you actually get that ebook for nothing. Just giving the thing away.
Oh, nice.
33444.
Unlike Anthony Fauci's. Yep. Unlike Anthony Fauci's speeches after this is all over, which will not be delivered for free. Just text lockdown to 33444. You know what I'm worried about is the movie. There'll be a movie, there'll be a book, and we can already predict what the story is going to be, that the smart people tried to tell us, but these stupid heads with their backwards baseball caps refused to listen to the science, and they're just going to pretend that Florida didn't exist. I've seen three plays and one comedy routine in Florida in the past couple of months. I mean, people are rehearsing plays in my state, and I am not driving by piles of corpses on my way to work.
Well, you've already seen that. Actually, Cuomo and Fauci were workshopping a script just a few months ago in a Zoom call where Fauci joined Cuomo to buttress St. Andrew of COVID-19 standing in New York City, in New York State, talking about, you know, maybe De Niro can play you and Pacino can play me and so on and so forth. They were having a good old time.
This is true.
So absolutely there will be movies. I hope... I mean, you know, he's perhaps Tony Fauci would be in line for some sort of like Obama-esque Netflix deal.
But yet, isn't it interesting that Cuomo had to say a few weeks ago, look, we have to start reopening because if we don't, his words were, there won't be anything left to reopen.
Yep.
Now, of course, we've been saying that all along, but it was so bizarre reading the comments on that because, of course, he's spent the last year terrifying everyone in New York. So they're not going to turn on a dime. They're all saying, why won't our governor keep us safe anymore? I mean, it's sad and scary.
I want to get your reaction to a couple of things Holman Jenkins wrote. Holman Jenkins in the Wall Street Journal has had a lot of good commentary on COVID over the many months. And he talked specifically in a recent piece about two lessons that we should learn that we won't. But, you know, he's trying. The first was taught in quick succession by Wuhan and then Northern Italy. When hospitals visibly break down, constraints on political action, much of it ill-advised, will tend to disappear. That's one lesson. So that perhaps this idea of restraint will be reconsidered the next time around. Number two, the lesson concerns the vaccine, and he's really been beating this drum that whether via challenge trials or suspending sort of the normal protocols with respect to the clinical trials to get a vaccine to market once the particular properties of the virus had been identified, which was like more than a year ago. We could have gotten a safe and effective, maybe not 95% effective, but still safe and effective vaccines to market faster than we otherwise did and saved many more lives in the process. And the argument that, oh, people wouldn't have confidence in it if we subverted the normal clinical trial procedures that are FDA mandated. Well, that turned out not to be true, too. I mean, there was just as much cynicism going through the FDA-demanded procedures because of all the politicization of everything COVID-related. What do you think about those two lessons, one on the vaccine and two on, you know, when the perception is the healthcare system is breaking down, then, you know, civil liberties and economic interests be damned?
Well, I agree with them both, and I'll elaborate on one of them. I think it's another lesson that comes out of the fear anyway of the health system breaking down is the importance of looking at numbers in context. We hear these scary numbers of the percentage of such and such beds in hospitals being occupied, and it sounds scary because none of us know. How do we know what the normal load of patients in a hospital is expected to be,
right,
in ICU beds or whatever? Compare it to previous years. The hospitals generally, in order to keep the lights on, the ICU has to be 90% full. You know, the beds have to be full 80 to 90, sometimes even higher percent. That's the way it is all the time. But nobody, so every time somebody tweets that out, some reporter breathlessly tells us, oh, this percentage of beds is occupied. I always ask, what percentage was occupied last year?
I know, I've asked
course,
that. What
crickets,
was it 5 years ago?
Bothered to look.
Yep, they don't look. Yeah. And then have you noticed, too, that the flu's gone? Do you know that we have one, Tom, we have one reported case of the flu in Chicago?
Yeah, now they try to explain that away by saying, oh, it's because of all our masks and social distancing. Yeah, okay, first of all, yeah, nice try. But also, even places that are notoriously lax about masks and social distancing also saw the flu disappear. So sorry, that excuse doesn't, because they're desperate to keep those masks on our faces. So mm-hmm. They're trying to find some reason to say it's been good, and now they're claiming the flu. But even where they're not, even Sweden doesn't have the flu, and Sweden is like 95% unmasked.
Yep.
So you and the story is that you don't identify something you're not testing for.
There's that, but they have been. The thing is that the test results have just been extremely low, and there are various explanations. It's not simply that all flu is being coded as COVID. That's one theory, but there's another theory that some people have had that in some ways COVID seems to crowd out other things, including influenza. I mean, there's no way for me to distinguish mm-hmm. or to discern what the truth is in here.
Tom Woods, New York Times bestselling author, senior fellow at the Mises Institute, and a host of The Tom Woods Show, author of Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About the Lockdown, A Non-Hysterical Guide to COVID-19. And give us the text message again where they can get the ebook.
You can text LOCKDOWN to the number 33444. And Dan, let me tell you something. You are one of the few radio hosts I've ever talked to who can correctly pronounce the name Mises. So congratulations, man.
I slog through Human Action, I'll have you know.
So, good, yes. Good for you. Yes. That is great to hear.
Tom, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the ebook.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Tom. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Does it bother you at all that your kids are being instructed by neo-segregationists, neo-racists? These are the terms of John McWhorter, Columbia University linguistics professor, African-American gentleman. Does it bother you that you're going along, you're suborning if you're in a position of authority, you're in one of the C-suites, or you're being forced to go along with neo-segregationist and neo-racist instruction in your businesses? Does that bother you at all?
Well, as you said earlier, you're sharing the delusion to survive. That speaks at a number of levels, by the way.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. This is Black History Month, but it's become Rewrite History Month, and there's a lot of tacit support or willful blindness and advancing it, isn't there? Is it sharing in the delusion to survive? To allow your kids to be instructed by neo-segregationists and neo-racists? Would you do that if they were being instructed by white supremacists?
Ooh.
Would you do that if your CEO brought in a white supremacist to instruct you about race relations? Then why do you do it when they bring in Ibram Kendi or Robin DiAngelo or any number of these race hustlers? Do you ask yourself that question? Do you ever wonder, to go back to our COVID discussion and Don Boudreau, you ever wonder about these things? Well, thankfully, people like John McWhorter do, and he has written a piece that outlines in Persuasion Community, where he posts some of his excellent thinking and writing. And this is an excerpt from his new book, The Elect, which is what he calls them. Neo-racists posing as anti-racists and their threat to a progressive America. Here is how he describes the anti-racists, the Ibram Kendis and the Robin DiAngelos, the race hustlers, that your school district retains to come in and educate your children about race relations, that you bring into your businesses, or your corporate leadership brings into your businesses to educate you about race relations. And I know people will be afraid to call in and talk about it. Fine. Go ahead. Turn your life over to people peddling a theory that ends with what we discussed last week. You are racist if you keep your dog outside, if you keep your dog inside, because some people have to keep their dogs outside, disproportionately a minority. That's your privilege. That makes you racist.
All right.
That's the intellectual rigor of these neo-racists and neo-segregationists.
It's a personal choice people make. That's not a racist move if you decide to keep your dog inside.
That really needs to be said?
I know. That's how sad things are right now.
The Tenants from John McWhorter. Here's how to be a good neo-racist. They call anti-racist. John McWhorter properly calls neo-racist. When black people say you have insulted them, apologize with profound sincerity and guilt. But don't put black people in a position where you expect them to forgive you. They have dealt with too much to be expected to. Number two, this is the anti-racist / neo-racist catechism, as he terms it. Black people are a conglomeration of disparate individuals. Black culture is code for pathological, primitive ghetto people. But don't expect black people to assimilate to white social norms because black people have a culture of their own. Silence about racism is violence, but elevate the voices of the oppressed over your own. You must strive eternally to understand the experience of black people, but you can never understand what it is to be black, and if you think you do, you're a racist. show an interest in multiculturalism, but do not culturally appropriate. What is not your culture is not for you, and you may not try it or do it, but if you aren't nevertheless interested in it, you're a racist. Support black people in creating their own spaces and then stay out of them. But seek to have black friends. If you don't have any, you're a racist. And if you claim any, they'd better be good friends in their private spaces you aren't allowed in. When whites move away from black neighborhoods, it's white flight. But when whites move into black neighborhoods, it's gentrification, even when they pay black residents generously for their houses. If you're white and only date white people, you're a racist. But if you're white and date a black person, you are, if only deep down, exotifying an other, you see. Black people cannot be held accountable for everything every black person does, but all whites must acknowledge their personal complicity in the perfidy throughout history of quote-unquote whiteness. Black students must be admitted to schools via adjusted grade and test score standards to ensure a representative number of them and foster a diversity of views in classrooms. But it is racist to assume a black student was admitted to a school via racial preferences, and racist to expect them to represent the diverse view in classroom discussions. McWhorter, after outlining the catechism, writes, I suspect deep down most know that none of this catechism makes any sense. Less obvious is that it was not composed with logic in mind. The self-contradiction of these tenets is crucial in revealing that third wave anti-racism is not a philosophy but a religion. The revelation of racism is itself and alone the point, the intention of this curriculum. As such, the fact if you think a little, the tenets cancel one another out is considered trivial. That they are that they serve their true purpose of revealing people as bigots is paramount, sacrosanct, as it were. The fundamental point here, in summary, from McWhorter, battling power relations and their discriminatory effects must be the central focus of all human endeavor, intellectual, moral, civic, artistic. You must allow that to consume your life. Those who resist this focus, or even evidence insufficient adherence to it, must be sharply condemned, deprived of influence, and ostracized. And that's why people won't talk about it, because they're cowards. How else to describe it?
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline. Excuse me.
You wouldn't tolerate any other sort of racism, any other sort of racial nonsense, but you tolerate this because you're afraid. So you turn over your schools and your businesses and your lives to these people. And I suspect no amount of reasoning from a superior intellect like John McWhorter, particularly as compared to the hustlers like Ibram Kendi of the world, who he's destroyed. And by the way, Ibram Kendi, by that I mean Henry Rogers, changed his name, probably won't get you out of the fear-addled state. Just another avenue to inflict fear for the purpose of control and submission. And people will dutifully go along, won't they? How much will they? Oh, and at what levels in terms of the creme de la creme of society, so to speak? They certainly think so. Bari Weiss, who used to be with the New York Times, she writes about the neo-segregationists too. A distressed parent writes me from Harvard Westlake. $41,000 a year is the tuition. It's the alma mater of Jake and Maggie Gyllenhaal. She tells me this fall a dean lavished praise upon Tamika Mallory and Linda Sarsour. These are the anti-Semitic organizers of the P-Hat marches. Both Louis Farrakhan fans. Lavish praise on them, both Louis Farrakhan fans, in a high school-wide assembly. She is shocked, so I mirror it back, but at this stage of the game in which Mallory is appearing in the pages of Vogue, I'm not surprised in the least. Then another parent at the school tells me of the school's 20-page plan outlining its anti-racist program. Policies include assessing word problems in math and rewriting them to be more representative and culturally sensitive, redesigning the 11th grade U.S. history course from a critical race theory perspective. I start writing it up only to see the news out of Dalton, tuition $54,000 a year. The Manhattan School managed to keep its manifesto to a mere 8 pages, but its demands include abolishing high-level academic courses by 2023 if the performance of black students is not on par with non-blacks, hiring 12 full-time diversity officers and multiple psychologists to support students, quote-unquote, coping with race-based traumatic stress, and compensating any student of color who appears in Dalton promotional material. Then there's Brentwood tuition, $45,000 a year. Announces some dialogue and community building sessions, which actually segregate families by race. I mean, I know we're used to that in Chicagoland. Oak Park River Forest was ahead of the learning curve with respect to doing neo-segregation.
Right. They had those, you know, fact-finding missions, remember, in the gym, and if you were white, you couldn't come. They locked you out.
Brentwood.
You weren't allowed in.
Yeah, Brentwood. Thursday, January 28th, 3:30 to 4:30, white faculty, white staff, white parents and families. Black faculty, black staff, black parents and families. Hispanic and Latinx parents and families. And so on and so forth. One wonders where the biracial families are slotted in, writes Barry Weiss. This is happening everywhere, so don't tell me it's not happening at your school, because I know it is. Now tell me what you're going to do about it. And I mean, you don't have to answer to me, but if you want to have a conversation about it, or you can, I guess, go back to what Amy said at the outset. You can just make this one of the delusions that you subscribe to, one of the areas where you do genuflect before the make-believers. But just understand, I mean, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, if you do, then you're perpetuating the new racial order, which is not going to end well for your kids, for your economic interests, or for this country. And I mean that black, white, Latino, Asian, across the board. The you know, division, unity, blah, 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 blah. I'm just invoking Frederick Douglass's words. You want to confer benefits or impose responsibilities by race and come over the top this way with the neo-racist catechism that John McWhorter nicely created for them. I mean, it's not something that they would adopt, but it's a great description of what they're doing and what they're teaching. Something like that. You think that ends well for anybody except those that are peddling this poison and getting paid handsomely to do so because of fraidy cat school administrators and C-suite executives? Joe in Bolingbrook, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, that comment of grounded, you know, I'm 27 years old. Like I said, I'm an African-American man, and real easy to fix this. If you're white, don't be afraid of, you know, being called racist, because there is right and there is wrong. And number two, in the black community, you know, somebody from my age, you know, I've never lived through oppression. I've only ever had opportunity. And it really drowns out our voices of people that are actually trying to work and not look for a handout. And in order to have the ideology of white superiority, you also need to accept, are you really saying that yourself as a black person, are you inferior? Because you have to believe in black inferiority if you believe in white supremacy. So what are they really trying to say by that?
That's a great point, Joe. Well stated. Thank you for the call. You are, channeling Bob Woodson. So Bob Woodson was listening. He'd be happy to hear a 27-year-old black man say that, because what is the idea? The idea, I can't do anything for myself in this country without a white person? How racist is that? Victoria in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Good morning.
Oh, hold on a second. Now Victoria in Burlington, Wisconsin. Sorry about that.
Yeah, good morning. I am a white woman, and I have a biracial grandson. So what is my label?
Right, exactly. Thanks for the call, Victoria. Just on that, we've had him on the show, but I would encourage people to pick up the documentary Eli Steele did a few years back, How Jack Became Black. And the documentary is about enrolling his son in the L.A. public school system, Eli Steele, the son of Shelby Steele, and his son, because of the woman he married, it's like his son is like white, black, Jewish, Latino, American Indian, Native American. So I'm sorry, which box do I check for that? And by the way, that's happening more and more. I think that something like one in six relationships in America are multiracial or biracial. So where's this going? So how do you keep this up? Well, they have an answer for that, don't they? However you identify. And how are people are going to identify? Well, you're told to be a victim, so identify with whatever gets you the most benefits from designating yourself a victim and whatever imposes the least responsibilities if you're identified as an oppressor, because there are only two categories of Americans according to these neo-racists and neo-segregationists, oppressors and victims. Deborah in Arlington Heights.
I heard a message not that long ago about victim versus victim mentality and the difference. A victim says, I'm a victim, but now I need to move forward and heal. Victim mentality, you did this to me, and now I'm never going to move forward. And what I deduce from all of this is basically we're never going to heal if you take this approach. And if you even talk to somebody who disagrees with you about systemic racism and you push back, they will have none of that. Like you said, then you're a racist if you don't acknowledge that entire package.
Thanks for the call, Deborah. Right. And I mean, remember, they make money by peddling divisiveness. So unity, their phony unity calls, is not just uniformity, you shall comply. It's also, we expect some of you not to comply. We hope you don't comply because divisiveness is good for business. Whether it's a school administrator, K through 12, university, or one of these guys like Kendi, who gets paid, $25,000, $50,000 to come tell a law firm that, all their white partners are racists. And here's what you can do to make your law firm anti-racist. Follow the John McWhorter Catechism. Steve in Orland Park.
Yeah, I have a question, a way around that. Well, I understand it's okay if I feel like a woman. What about if I feel like a black man? There's no problem then, right?
Well, I mean, Rachel Dolezal. Thanks for the call.
Oh, yeah,
Steve.
Sean King.
Sean King.
Oh, Sean King was good. That was really I fell for that one, hook, line, and sinker.
As long as you're otherwise complying with their make-believe rules and regulations, you can participate in the make-believe.
That's why I still love the guy. Remember who tried to change his age because he's 65, but he wanted to get younger chicks? But he felt 45, so he asked the judge to change his age on his birth certificate.
Yeah.
Why not? He said, well, why not? Because people are changing their names or genders. I don't feel 65. I'm 45. Brilliant.
It was
a great effort.
If you get to live in your make-believe world, I get to live in mine.
Exactly.
And that's fine. You can live in a make-believe world if you want. The problem comes when you force other people to live in that world.
Yep.
And you deprive them of opportunities or you impose responsibilities in order to foster your make-believe world. That's where we get into a bit of a problem. Paula and Racine.
Hi there. So I used to live in Illinois. I still have lots of friends in Illinois, and I alerted a bunch of them about kind of what's coming with the pending school legislation, and it's been crickets. You know, a lot of my friends live kind of in Glenview in the North Shore, and some think that if they lay low, it'll pass, that it's more important to stay in, you know, kind of the elite pipeline. Others don't understand that it's coming for them. And then some are just kind of a head in the sand approach. It's like paralysis waiting for a savior. And even those, I guess, a few who get it and know, they're just paralyzed because they just don't know what to do. So it's just kind of my perspective. I used to live there.
It's a great perspective because I think that that's my sense of it. And so you were more in that milieu than me. And that's what I think is happening. So I appreciate that description. I think, that's my sense of accurately what's transpiring. Thanks for the call. But I mean, how do you, my pushback is, so how do you justify that position? And how can you be, at once, like, I'm so well educated, I'm a successful professional, I have no idea what to do in the face of nonsense. You can't reconcile those two things. That is not a compelling response. I'm sorry. Dawn in Plainfield.
Yeah, that's the response, Dan, Amy, because they've never been affected. So my twins have never been allowed in gen ed. I've asked. I've had, 4 years ago, I've had a mediation meeting with the Illinois State Board of Education. I've had state-facilitated IEPs with the Illinois State Board of Education. They know this is a problem. So when I read this proposed amendment about understanding the difference between prejudice and discrimination, they don't care about prejudice and discrimination. They know this is a problem in Illinois. So I've, you know what? I sent an email out to the Illinois State Board of Education, Special Education Department. I want to know, there are least restrictive environment laws and rules in which kids with special needs are not supposed to be kicked out of the classroom just because they have a disability. They are supposed to be monitoring. So I'm waiting to hear from a response from them when they're what monitoring they're doing. And get that on the ground first. Implement that first. Open up your eyes first before you get this other amendment and even think about changing. This is just ridiculous. I'm so upset. And you know what? I'm just a drop in the bucket. I'm like one person, and it's not just an Illinois issue. It is a national issue, but especially in the state of Illinois. And the Illinois State Board of Education is a blind eye to it. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dawn. Yeah. No, I know. I know. And this is, you know, one of the great examples of how barbaric Illinois has become is how we treat, we as a state, state government, politicians, what we allow, head in sand, as was described on that issue, like so many others, how we allow people with developmental disabilities and their families to be scammed. All sorts of flowery rhetoric from politicians and bureaucrats, and the reality is something very different. One of the worst states in the country when it comes to provision of services for the developmentally disabled, whether that's in terms of physical and mental services or whether it's in the K-12 setting as Dawn was describing.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.